this is Derek Frost from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. And we start on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal with the headline across the top of the page, Developers of 26-Story Tower Seek Incentives. And this article is written by Amanda Jones Hoyle with the Dateline of Durham. Developers of a 26-story tower project proposed in downtown Durham say their request for $8 million in local incentives is crucial to making the $85 million building project a reality. We won't be able to make the project work without them, says Paul Smith, managing partner for Austin Lawrence Partners, a Colorado-based real estate firm that wants to build the most ambitious new building project in downtown Durham since Durham Center Office Tower opened in 1988. Austin Lawrence Partners has been working on plans for its 26-story building, tentatively called City Center, since purchasing a vacant lot in late 2012 at the corner of Corcoran and Main Street, site of the former E.W. Woolworth store. The pending incentive deals with the city and the county have accelerated in recent weeks as Austin Lawrence prepares to break ground on the project by the fall. The company is seeking incentives to help cover costs of building the tower and the redevelopment of several properties along Parrish and Main Streets, including the nearby Jack Tar Motel property. It's all driven by the cost of parking in an urban environment, Smith says. Durham County's Board of Commissioners and Durham City Council have signaled they're willing to negotiate an incentive agreement for about $4 million each. Kevin Dick, Durham's Director of Economic and Workforce Development, says none of the incentives would be paid out until the project was complete, and the incentives would be distributed over a 15-year period. He estimates the city will gain $8.3 million more in property sales and occupancy taxes from the project, and the county will gain about $11.9 million in new taxes. The incentive agreement wouldn't be without precedence. The city and the county pitched in a combined $40 million to build two new parking decks for the American Tobacco Historic District. The tower, expected to be completed by mid to late 2016, is projected to have 125,000 square feet of office space, 25,000 square feet of retail space, and 132 residential units, 23 of which will be sold as condominiums. Smith confirms that Duke University has already committed to leasing 55,000 square feet. For the Jack Tar Motel property, the developer plans to renovate and increase the hotel's room count from 44 to 75 rooms by converting some of its empty retail space into the hotel space, Smith says. Austin Lawrence would also be able to use the motel's 260-space parking deck for the tower. A lot of people assume we would tear it down, but we kind of like the motel's mid-century modern design, and we'd like to bring it back to life as a hotel, Smith says. According to TBJ's latest space report, Central Durham had a 5% vacancy in Class A office buildings, making it one of the tightest office markets in the area. Rates of some of those existing buildings, such as Durham Center and the Diamond View 3 building, hovered anywhere from $25 to $30 per square foot. And just below that article on the front page of the Triangle Business Journal, there's the beginning of the cover story. It's a large picture of two men standing in the shadows, and the headline is on top of them. It says, "Show us the money." While the Triangle is replete with talent, technology, and innovation, access to venture capital remains a challenge for growing biotech companies. And this article is written by Jason DeBrun with the Dateline of Durham. And once we turn inside, there's a second headline. The buck stop here. The Triangle's got talent. Why don't we get the VC funds? Research Triangle Park area biotechnology companies fall woefully short of their competitors in the Northeast and West Coast in obtaining funding from venture capital groups. From 1995 through 2013, biotechnology companies in North Carolina, which are primarily located in the RTP region, took in slightly more than $2 billion of venture-backed money. During that same time, similar companies in the New England area took in more than $13 billion, and those in Silicon Valley took in more than $17 billion, six and eight times more than in North Carolina, according to venture capital data compiled by PricewaterhouseCoopers. A comparison of venture money to science grant funding from the National Institutes of Health shows that although North Carolina scientists compete well for grant funding, they fall short in parlaying that into venture money. In 2012, North Carolina took in more than $1 billion in NIH funding, but only $132 million in life sciences venture funding, a difference factor of more than 8 times. By comparison, the difference factors in California and Massachusetts were only 1.2 and 2, respectively, according to an analysis by the North Carolina Biotechnology Center, a group that supports biopharma activity in North Carolina. That reflects the fact that companies here are not doing as well at converting NIH funding to venture capital, says Peter Ginsburg, the North Carolina Biotechnology Center's Vice President of Business and Technology Development. It's staggering and unfortunate. Companies here have to be more creative about identifying funding sources. Many companies here have to attract funding from VCs outside the region, and that's difficult because VCs want to be close to the companies they are funding. Which comes first, money or talent? Conversations with small and large biotech companies, venture groups, and advocates, as well as analysts of the biopharma industry, reveal a conundrum. Drug development companies say that venture capital needs to have a local presence to attract good entrepreneurs, while those on the venture side say the triangle needs more entrepreneurs to attract the venture. The big shortfall that we have in the area is talented entrepreneurs that can deploy capital in effective ways to build these sustainable enterprises, says Art Pappas, managing general partner at Durham-based Pappas Ventures, which invests in the life sciences sector. Whatever the reason, a dearth of local venture capital funds puts the triangle at risk of losing upstart biopharma companies to other parts of the country. Flag Therapeutics is an example. The company, founded by two former pharma executives, one from Patheon Pharmaceuticals and the other from GlaxoSmithKline, licensed a compound from Duquesne University, but set up shop in Raleigh's Briar Creek because they know it's important to be in the biopharma cluster to be successful, something they say isn't possible in Pittsburgh. But if a venture firm up north or out west offers to fund their project on the condition that they move closer, Frank Sorge and Greg Davis say they would pack their bags before the echo of the phone call leaves their home office. A VC might say, "In order to keep tabs on my investment, I would like you to be within a half hour of my office," says Sorge. So they might say, "We will fund you, but we want you to move to Boston." Sorge says that the choice between receiving funding but moving and not receiving funding isn't much of a choice. On the other hand, venture groups say that if companies have something good to offer, the money will find them. Money is a little bit fungible when it comes to location, says Dr. Anand Mehra, a partner with Sofinova Ventures in Menlo Park, California, a group that's invested in RTP companies like Aerie Pharmaceuticals. We don't mind traveling when it comes to finding good companies. Indeed, the recently added nonstop flight between San Francisco and Raleigh-Durham International Airport helps bring the two areas closer, say many drug developers here in RTP. I think there is a real chicken-and-egg problem here, Davis says. Does the money track the investments, or do the investments track the money? In search of an anchor. Some have questioned if the academic culture of the triangle adds to the problem. After all, the area has major research institutions, and not just at the universities, where science could overshadow entrepreneurship. Mehra discredits that notion, especially in recent years, as leaders from the area's research universities have pushed for strong technology transfer offices that encourage faculty to think like entrepreneurs. Ken Moak, CEO of Chimerix, a Durham-based drug developer that successfully went public in 2013, says it might just take more time. The RTP area hasn't had the enormous companies locate their headquarters here, like a Genentech in San Francisco, for example, to serve as a sort of incubator for spin-out companies. GlaxoSmithKline has filled that role to a certain extent, and the RTP region is littered with companies with former execs from GSK and its predecessors. Similarly, Fred Eshelman started and sold the contract research organization PPD and is now working to build Furiex Pharmaceuticals, a publicly traded drug development company that has attracted Wall Street's attention favorably. Sources for this story agree that Quintiles, the contract research organization that went public in 2013 for nearly $1 billion, could serve in that role, and its executives might very well spin out new companies, but agree with Moak's point that it could take more time. Building brand. Moak says entrepreneurs in the Triangle should work together with more urgency to make the area more attractive, are attractive enough that venture capitalists have no choice but to come here. I think we need more innovative, interesting deals coming out of the local scientific infrastructure, he says. It won't happen overnight, but it's not impossible. Some of that support network is already happening. The North Carolina Biotechnology Center sets up events in Boston or San Francisco, to which they bring a handful of RTP companies to pitch in front of a dozen or more VC groups. This not only helps those companies, but the RTP region as a whole, says Ginsburg. Some VCs weren't confident enough that there was enough regular deal flow to warrant a full-time presence in the Triangle, he says. We've taken steps as the Biotech Center to dispel that notion. Ginsburg says his group is still at the stage when they must seek out the VC groups, but within 3 to 5 years he hopes to be attracting them this way. Moak wants even more collaboration. We need a lot more connectivity and focus on people that are already here, he says. I think we have all the pieces. We just need to work as a group to make it happen. And now we turn inside the Triangle Business Journal to the Biz column. A quick glance at Triangle happenings. The headline that starts it off, looking for golf in all the right places. For avid golfers in the Triangle area, Reg Jones's name should sound familiar. He ran the Pinehurst Resort business for a number of years and played host to numerous Triangle companies hosting events and conferences. But nowadays, Jones calls the world his employer, especially this year. You see, Jones is putting together the U.S. Men's Open and the U.S. Women's Open on behalf of the United States Golf Association. Biz caught up with him in the past couple of days to gauge the temperature of the major tournaments being held in our neck of the woods after 9 years. Right now, we're building the infrastructure, our stadium, so to speak, Jones says. The region has been extremely supportive, and just like 2005, this will be one of the most successful U.S. Opens in history financially. The USGA has reserved 3,000 rooms, including condos and homes for the players, the association's VIPs, corporate staff, and support personnel. Rooms were booked in Fayetteville, Laurinburg, Sanford, and a few other towns, including some in the Triangle, Jones says. Biz wonders if the so-called money players get to select their choice of accommodations. Can you see Tiger Woods hanging out in Laurinburg? Frozen musical team has family ties to North Carolina. Biz has always felt a connection to the world of motion pictures and the people that help make them, but until the recent Oscars, that was only a fantasy. Turns out that Biz's good friend and resident advisor in school at Campbell University, Matt Rogers, works with the sister of Kristen Anderson Lopez at classical public radio station WDAV in Davidson. Anderson Lopez, along with her husband Robert Lopez, grabbed the Oscar for Best Original Song for Let It Go, from Disney's animated film Frozen. As a matter of fact, the husband and wife team wrote the music and lyrics for all of the songs on the movie soundtrack. Rogers says he can't believe his coworker even showed up at work the next day. I told her I'd be recovering from celebrating. Congrats, Kristen, or as John Travolta would say, Karen Alexander. Their finest hour is lunchtime. With whom would you like to have lunch? It's a question Biz asked Jim Whiter, CEO of Raleigh-based Red Hat. His answer? Winston Churchill. I've always been fascinated by Winston Churchill, and if given the opportunity, I would be interested in having lunch with him, he says. In high school, I read a biographical 6-volume set recounting his memories of World War II, I told you I loved history, that offered an in-depth account of his decisions and reasoning. As I worked my way through the set, I found myself enthralled by Churchill. In his personal life, Churchill had many flaws, including arrogance, but as an orator, he possessed a great moral compass and the ability to connect with people to bring them together. I think it would be intriguing to sit down with him and see why, despite many obstacles, he became one of the most well-known leaders of the 20th century. Whitehurst will have the chance to have lunch with somebody. The North Carolina Technology Association is auctioning off lunch with North Carolina CEOs as part of its latest fundraiser. Too bad there's no such thing as a time machine. 6 months in, sales soar at Jimmy V's. When Jim Henning and Northview Hotel Group opened the Jimmy V's Osteria and Bar restaurant at the Sheridan Hotel in downtown Raleigh last September, they committed from day one to contributing 2.5% of the restaurant revenue to the V Foundation for Cancer Research based in Cary. Only 6 months in, the restaurant has collected $40,537 for the Charity Foundation, named to honor the late Jim Valvano, the former basketball coach at NC State University and ESPN commentator who died of cancer. That's well beyond what Henning says they had expected they'd be able to contribute when the restaurant opened September 24. We had projected this would be a $2.4 million a year restaurant, and we're already on track to reach $3.5 million to $4 million in our first year. Northview's Henning presented the restaurant's first check to the V Foundation's Nick Valvano and Sherry Mazur at a ceremony on March 20. Cary Chamber gets new Echo Devo chief. The Cary Chamber of Commerce has chosen one of its own to replace Sandy Jordan, the town's recently retired vice president of economic development, to lead the town's effort to recruit new industry investment and jobs. Kyle Greer, a commercial real estate broker with NAI Carroll Atlantic Realty and a three-year member of the Cary Chamber's board of directors, has been chosen to succeed Jordan, says Cary Chamber President Howard Johnson. As a lifelong resident of Wake County and a graduate of NC State University, Greer says he knows his new role will be a big challenge from his work the last 8 years at Carroll Atlantic. "But I love Cary and I love the business here, and I really think I can do a lot of good things here," he says. Greer starts April 7. Contributing to Biz were staffers Cameron Snipes, Lauren Onsorge, and Amanda Jones Hoyle. Now we return to our full-length stories in the Triangle Business Journal. The first headline we come to, Novan eyes new funder following Acne Med results. That's Novan, spelled N-O-V-A-N, and this article is written by Jason DeBrun with a Dateline of Durham. Durham drug developer Novan Therapeutics announced positive results on March 19 from studies on its new acne treatment, leading CEO Nate Stasko to start thinking more seriously about fundraising. "This study really greenlights our investment," he said after announcing positive results from a Phase 2 trial on SB204, a topical treatment Novan is developing. The study showed that those who received the Novan treatment, called SB204 for now, showed benefits 3 times faster than those who got a placebo. Tests on the product also showed no serious side effects. But Novan is a long way away from its final goals. The company has raised $20 million, but will need significantly more capital to finish Phase 2 testing and push through a Phase 3 trial, typically the final step before submitting a new drug application with the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. Novan raised the $20 million from individual investors, including Neil Hunter, the co-founder of Cree Incorporated, and Bob Ingram, former CEO and chairman of GlaxoWelcome, names that carry significant cachet. To raise enough money to continue development, however, will require a venture partner or other group with access to larger amounts of investment capital. "We've had a great pedigree of investors to date, but this will definitely exceed our network," Stasko says, without offering specifics. Working in Novan's favor, Stasko argues, is the fact that its acne treatment would be considered a novel therapy, different from anything currently on the market. Many treatments today use an oral antibacterial to treat acne. However, the body will develop a resistance to the antibiotic. This is not only of concern from a national health perspective, but also from a commercial standpoint. If the drug stops working, it will lead the patients to other products. SB204 uses a nitric oxide therapy in a topical treatment which eliminates the possibility of developing an antibiotic resistance. Dr. Hilary Baldwin, dermatologist at SUNY Downstate Medical Center, University Hospital of Brooklyn, backs that thinking. There currently remains a need for new agents to treat the growing number of patients suffering from acne vulgaris, she says in a prepared statement circulated by Novan. Novan's phase 2 results of SB204 were very impressive, having demonstrated a rapid and clear dose response in subjects with severe acne. Baldwin was not compensated by Novan, according to the company. In terms of the company's future, Stasco leaves pretty much every option open, including selling the company, finding a partner to develop and market the drug, or even taking it to market with money raised from investors. And now we turn to the reporter pages. The first one we come to is for Amanda Hoyle. Hoyle covers commercial and residential real estate. And in her section, there's one article headlined, From Alligator Alley to Tar Heel State. For the first time in more than 30 years, an outsider to Wake County government will be taking over the county's top administrative post. But Jim Hartman, the new county manager who takes office April 14, won't be an outsider to everyone in the region. Kirby Bowers, executive director of Triangle J Council of Governments, worked with Hartman in Northern Virginia in the mid-2000s when Bowers was county manager for Loudoun County and Hartman was city manager for Alexandria, Virginia in neighboring Fairfax County. I'm looking forward to working with Jim again, Bowers says. My impression was he had a great reputation in Alexandria. He was a great listener and would always look at all sides and wouldn't rush to judgment. I know that he will be very active with us in the region. Hartman is currently serving as county manager of Seminole County, Florida, a suburb of Orlando, and has been for nearly 3 years. But he and his wife have strong ties to Florida. Both he and his wife have strong ties to Florida, but Hartman says he was intrigued by the prospect of working for Wake County, which he says has a huge reputation among city and county management circles. To attain and maintain AAA bond rating status is very notable, he says. Hartman says the commissioner's 2014 goals plan will be his blueprint for his first year on the job. The first year is always very intense with lots of long days and long meetings, he says, but I've been through it before. My first priority will be getting to know as much about the people of the county in order to make good decisions. It's important to understand those kinds of things because every decision will have a consequence. I like to be able to anticipate those consequences, good or bad. Hartman will be only the fifth county manager in Wake County's history, preceded by David Cook, who retired in November after serving 13 years in the role, Richard Stevens, Carl Johnson, and Garland Jones. And there's also a blurb with Jim Hartman's information. Title, Wake County Manager, starting April 14. Age, 61. Education, Master's Degree in Public Administration from University of Central Florida. Salary, $220,000 per year. Previous experience, County Manager for Seminole County, Florida. City Manager for Alexandria, Virginia. County Administrator for Spartanburg County, South Carolina. And Eagle County, Colorado. Hobbies, photography, especially travel photography, and landscapes. And now we have the page for reporter Jason DeBrun. DeBrun covers healthcare and biopharmaceuticals. The headline on his article, Patient Engagement is All the Buzz. Raleigh healthcare technology developer Axial Exchange will partner with Becker's Hospital Review to rank hospitals nationwide on how well they engage with their patients. The partnership with Becker's, a nationally respected brand, gives Axial further clout and punctuates its position in the growing healthcare technology market. Using publicly available data on patient engagement, Axial ranks hospitals on patient engagement. CEO Joanne Rode emphasizes this because Axial's report ranks hospitals on verifiable objective data. Rode says that she and her team don't know the rankings much in advance of a public release because they combine and condense data instead of ranking on subjective terms. Charlotte area hospitals largely outperformed those in the Triangle in patient engagement, although Rex Healthcare ranks as number one in the state. Hospital executives pay close attention to these engagement scores, especially as reimbursements are now tied in part to them. Patient satisfaction surveys are nothing new, of course, but the federal government only recently introduced a standardized survey in an effort to improve overall quality. Patient engagement is increasingly at the center of healthcare reform, and achieving excellence in clinical outcomes has been proven dependent upon enhanced patient involvement, said Lindsay Dunn, editor-in-chief of Becker's Hospital Review. Partnering with Axial Exchange, the first organization to develop a metric for evaluating patient engagement efforts and programs to expand their regional patient engagement index on a national level was a natural choice. We are proud to work with Axial Exchange to extend this industry-first benchmark for assessing hospitals' efforts to engage patients in their care. And now we have the page of reporter Dawn Curry. Curry covers small business, personalities, and Triangle trends. The first headline, entrepreneur with fashion flair. A recent Kickstarter campaign run by Raleigh-based designer Catherine Fain, creator of Raimi Rhodes women's fashion line, finished better than the owners expected. The goal was $6,500 to fund technical design costs, pattern making, fabric and trim, cutting and sewing, and digital and print marketing, all for a trip to the Savannah Fashion Week show. But when the online fundraiser completed, Fain had racked up $7,198 with 71 backers. One of those backers was local tech investor F. Scott Moody. I came across a tweet about the campaign and always try to be supportive of Triangle entrepreneurs in several ways, whether tweeting about them, offering friendly advice over a coffee, or sometimes funding, says Moody in an email when I asked him why he was backing Fain. One of my daughters is working to be a fashion entrepreneur herself later this year. Take all those, fashion, Triangle, and entrepreneurism, and I am happy to help out, even if in some very small way. Moody is the former CEO of Authentech, the company bought by Apple to equip the new iPhones with fingerprint scanning technology. Moody is managing director of First Talent Ventures and a venture partner at Stonehenge Capital. He also recently invested in Fortnite Brewery Company in Cary. Fain's clothes, mostly women's fine casual wear, are made in Los Angeles, and she collaborates with the manufacturer via Skype, email, and phone. They are 3 hours behind, so it's easy for me to get off work and get on a call, says Fain. Fain describes her Savannah runway outfits as light bohemian. And one more article in this section is headlined, Something Old Meets Something New. Gay Bratton of Raleigh, owner of Gabrielle Jewelry, is proving you can make it as a female artist living in a tech hub. Bratton started her business in Charleston 3 years ago after receiving her Bachelor's of Fine Arts from the University of Georgia, Lamar Todd School of Art. For her thesis, she cast lace fabric into metal to make jewelry and shortly thereafter appeared in Garden & Gun magazine after winning the Made in the South Award in the style category. She started her business right after the recession hit, and she says says had it not been for Garden & Gun, she may not be on the map. Her jewelry is being sold at the Umstead Hotel and Spa in Cary and is displayed in the Gibbs Museum of Charleston. Her pieces run from $75 to $3,200. I don't know anybody that casts fabric into metal, she says, while speaking to me in her South Raleigh studio. But what's impressive is that she supports it herself, working full-time to find handmade lace from around the world through online sources such as eBay.com to cast into raw metal to make necklaces, rings, bracelets, earrings, and hair pieces, some of which is pure gold. Her work is often used in weddings. And now we turn to the page of reporter Lauren Onsorge. Onsorge covers technology and entrepreneurship. There are two articles here. The first one's headlined, RST Fiber is out to make North Carolina a gigabit state. As Google Fiber was contemplating a Triangle expansion, a small company in Shelby was quietly plotting an attack. On March 11, RST Fiber surged out of stealth mode, announcing that it had teamed up with networking giant Cisco to deploy more than 3,000 miles of high-speed 100 gigabit cable. Overnight, North Carolina became the first gigabit state. And in as few as 60 days, that designation will mean high-speed internet with or without Google here in Raleigh. Dan Limerick, the RST CEO at the center of the story, says it's all about what Cisco CEO John Chambers calls the Internet of Everything. It's a concept Chambers delivered in person in August of last year at Prestonwood Country Club for the North Carolina CEO Forum, telling leaders the world is changing, that a wave of complete digitization is coming, and they need to be ready or else. Shared information, he said, will double every day in the future, and the companies willing to change will survive. That's what it's about, says Limerick. In the not-too-distant future, everything in our homes, our cars, everything is going to be connected, and the networks that are deployed today, they cannot support the bandwidth that is going to be required to make the Internet of Everything work. Limerick says that why Cisco says that that's why Cisco approached him, and that's what's driving the mission. Mark my words, you will look back on today's conversation and say, I spoke to this old man and he was the guy that helped birth the Internet of Everything, he says. Even before the Cisco partnership, the Triangle was in RST's crosshairs. The Research Triangle Park-based Microelectronics Center of North Carolina, MCNC, leased fiber from its Golden Leaf Rural Broadband Initiative last year. Joe Fredoso, CEO of MCNC, tells me the leased fiber includes a route running up Highway 401 through Fuquay Varina that filters into downtown Raleigh. A private sector, for-profit carrier using the network to offer high bandwidth services in areas of the state that would not see these services for generations if not for the MCNC investments and work, he says. We are seeing more high bandwidth offerings in more places in the state because of the GLRBI. What RST Fiber is doing gives his project validation, he says. Limerick says that in 60 to 90 days, the Raleigh area will be hooked in, with Durham and Orange counties connecting in the months that follow. Specifically, RST is installing access points on buildings and towers throughout Raleigh with about 1.5-mile range. So if you are within 1.5 to 2 miles, you can receive our service up to 1 gigabit symmetrical, he explains. It's a portal. Once you're in range, it will be like signing on to hotel Wi-Fi with a password. Once you've typed in your credit card information, $99 per month for residential service, you get automatic fiber internet on that device. You can also get high-tech television for an additional fee. Business plans will exist at varying prices. People can indicate interest on RST's website, and that interest will determine where access points are placed. And the next article, Christmas Jammies duo could get reality show. Production companies line up for a shot at couple's real-life tale. Christmas Jammies could soon be a reality show, sort of. The makers of the viral video hit, former WNCN news anchor Penn Holderness and his wife, former Inside Edition correspondent Kim Dean Holderness, are being shopped. Penn Holderness tells me multiple production companies have contacted them about a reality show. Reality shows, they go in cycles and they're all looking for the same thing all the time, he says. For a while it was Strong, Crazy Women. Then it was big, outrageous groups of characters. And the next thing people are looking for is a family business. The success of Duck Dynasty didn't hurt that cause, he points out. Holderness and team have narrowed the field to one undisclosed company. And while he won't let me print the name, he does say they've had some past reality television show successes. A pilot could start filming soon, but this show may be different from others in a big way. We're not going to do a show where our kids are going to be the forefront of it, he says. We don't want them to be Honey Boo Boo. Their kids have no idea a reality show is even in the cards, he laughs. Holderness, a Durham native who met his wife while working as the sports guy in Orlando. She was a news reporter for a different station, and we were both dating other people. Then a few months later, we weren't dating other people. In 2003, says his company is a fun change from the suit atmosphere of a television station. It's awesome, he says. I'm wearing clothes that could easily be confused with pajamas. I shave for the first time in 3 days. It's great. The business started from a media training firm his wife operated with another former news anchor, Sharon Delaney McLeod. The company helped politicians and CEOs present themselves on television. Last fall, Holderness realized it could be a full-time job. That's when he quit television and created that Christmas Jammies video. We did not expect 14 million people to see it, but that's what happened, he says, adding that suddenly people didn't want the typical industrial videos anymore. We had people calling in saying, we want to do something fun. And now we turn to our small business profile. This one is on Acroprint Time Recorder Company. And Acroprint has its headquarters in Raleigh, year founded 1969. Number of employees, 55. Annual revenue, less than $15 million. The headline on the article, Still Ticking After All These Years. This article is written by Don Curry with the Dateline of Raleigh. Ever since the federal government began requiring every business to keep track of hourly employees' time, American workers have been punching a time clock. One Raleigh business has made a business of keeping time, persisting and growing for 45 years by both adapting to technological changes and holding on to what's tried and true. Acroprint, founded in 1969 by Wilbur Robbins, has lasted this long by making new ways for employers to track their workers' hours. The family business was passed down to his son, Glenn Robbins, who is coaching his daughter, Amanda Robbins-Jones, to take over one day. Their business isn't limited to selling the basic green punch clock that took them through into the 1980s. The company has also branched out into biometrics, fingerprint scanning and face recognition, and software that allows employees to access a web-based time clock. Acroprint has about 5,000 dealers that supply time clocks to businesses around the globe, and according to company spokesperson Diane All, the decades-old electromagnetic punch clock comprises more than half of all equipment sales. Our systems products, which include software, biometrics, and badge terminal systems, comprise just under half of our total time and attendance equipment sales, says All. Systems products are a group as a group began outselling the electromechanical green clocks as of 2013, and they're gaining in share of the total category, but the combined electromechanical and electronic punch clock sales still just edges them out. Because most companies need a way to measure and track attendance, Acroprint's demand slowed but didn't disappear during the recession. A lot of companies were laying people off and new companies were not being developed, says Robbins, but employers still needed time clocks. Time clocks are, to an extent, recession-proof because employers can't afford to pay overtime, and the clocks are a relatively small investment for any business, says Jones, so they protect the employer and the employee. And since Automatic Data Processing Incorporated hotly competes with Acroprint, the latter launched AcroTime, a web-based workforce management platform that's customizable to any international standard, such as displaying the month before the date. Most of the company's exports head to Mexico and Canada. In the U.S., most of the devices end up at businesses with fewer than 50 employees. But Robin says his line of devices can handle a manufacturing plant with 1,000 workers if needed. Other than the 1970s-style square green models that are made in Raleigh, the company holds a trademark on the color green for time recorders. The products are manufactured primarily in China. Acroprint's products range in price from $440 to $1,000. Last year, the company sold 12,000 of the green clocks, with the day after daylight saving time begins or ends being the company's busiest days. Diane calls it all hands on deck, and we have to bring on additional people just to field calls because people are calling wanting to know how to change their clock, says Jones. Jones grew up in the company where many employees have stayed on for more than 20 years. During college, she took an internship at Acroprint and spent a few weeks in each department. So I really know the ins and outs. I most enjoyed the assembly. I like the guts of the clock and putting it together, knowing I made that. And I like quality control, she says. The green clocks have been spotted in TV shows, commercials, and movies. Acroprint even has a page on its website dedicated to clock sightings. What was a contemporary green in the 1970s has become a popular retro look. And now we turn to the People on the Move section in the Triangle Business Journal to read the People Spotlight. And this spotlight is on Stacy Mangum, president of RPG Solutions. Armed with a degree in psychology, Stacy Mangum has parlayed that knowledge into a career in the human resources industry. The latest stop on her HR tour is as president of Raleigh-based RPG Solutions, an outsourced HR services provider. In that role, Mangum manages internal processes and works daily to increase the solutions offered to RPG's Triangle-based clients. She also supervises a team of 20, including HR professionals and account managers within the company, and will work to build the benefits and HR services divisions over the coming years. RPG Solutions is helmed by its founder and CEO, Phil Gruber. What's one thing you wish people knew about your job? How challenging and how much fun it is at the same time. Born and raised? I was born in Indiana, but raised a Texan. What are your goals for this position? We expect to grow by more than 30% in 2014 and double in size by the end of 2016. We believe, and our growth bears it out, that our clients value our integrated service model that offers comprehensive employee benefits and HR consulting solutions. I will continue to grow our company and model while guiding our team to remain flexible and realize that one size does not fit all when it comes to providing solutions to employee matters. We listen closely to our clients' needs and customize our services and to meet those needs, whether navigating the confusing waters of healthcare reform or HR legalities. Biggest pet peeve? Group texting and reply all. Biggest worry? I think as a parent, I worry about my kids growing up happy and finding a special someone to share life's moments with. Triangle area business person you most admire? It's hard to choose one, so I'm throwing two names out there. Jeff Mangum, my husband and owner, CEO of Triangle Landscape Supplies. He has a tough job keeping up with me. Also, Eric Hall, president and CEO of Communities and Schools of North Carolina. If I had to pick someone besides Jeff, it would be Eric on how he's making this, taking this nonprofit to the next level. Education. I graduated cum laude with my business and psychology degrees from Wesleyan College and leadership and coaching certificate from Georgetown University. Personal, husband Jeff and two children, Tyler, who is 21, and Alexa, who is 16. Our family also works together on our family business, Triangle Landscape Supplies. Last book read, Beyond Belief by John Grinnell. And on the Viewpoint page in the Triangle Business Journal, we have a guest opinion. And this guest opinion is from Matthew W. Patsky, who is the CEO of Trillium Asset Management, an investment firm with $1.4 billion under management. Trillium is based in Boston, Massachusetts, and has an office in Durham. The headline on the guest opinion, Reject Repeal of Renewable Energy Law. As large companies with well-known brands move toward more sustainable business practices, they are increasingly taking advantage of renewable energy and becoming more energy efficient, especially when those actions affect their own bottom line. When these companies make decisions about how and where to start or expand their business or install energy projects, they look to states with strong energy policies. A recent market report shows that North Carolina is now second in the nation in solar installations, trailing only California. While the state doesn't yet have any major wind installations, there are already 23 manufacturers producing components for wind turbines. In North Carolina, Apple, IKEA, Biltmore, SAS, and QVC, among others, have installed on-site solar power generation facilities. It is reported that half of the companies in the Fortune 100 and two-thirds of companies in the Global 100 have a clean energy goal. With this in mind, legislators should again reject efforts to weaken the state's renewable energy and energy efficiency portfolio standard, REPS. North Carolina passed its REPS law in 2007, requiring Duke Energy, Progress Energy, and Dominion North Carolina Power to procure at least 12.5% of their electric supply from clean energy sources by 2021. Municipal utilities and cooperatives are required to meet a target of 10% by 2018. The standard has been a significant driver of job growth in North Carolina's clean energy industry, with nearly 20,000 full-time equivalent jobs across the state. Despite the benefits that REPS, or REPS, has brought, many legislators want to weaken the standard. Legislators wisely rejected repeal efforts last year, and they should do so again in 2014. The argument that renewable energy is a burden on electricity prices has only become more inaccurate with time. Between 2008 and 2012, solar costs fell by 80%. A recent study by RTI LaCapra Associates found that North Carolina's clean energy policies will result in an estimated long-term $173 million in net savings for electricity customers. A continued commitment to clean energy will allow North Carolina to capitalize on the huge investment and job opportunities that have yet to be realized. It will show businesses and investors that the state is serious about being a leader in clean energy solutions that propel economic growth. And still on the Viewpoint page, we'll read the guest column. This guest column is written by Alex Schroeder, a Harvard University graduate who is a principal at Prisma Group, a Raleigh-based business development and investment firm that assists U.S. companies with international expansion. And the headline on the guest column, "When Pursuing Global Expansion Strategy, Proceed with Caution." The topic of expanding internationally is on many owners' minds these days. While growth at home may be sluggish and uncertain, exports can offer attractive opportunities for profitable growth. Think about a scenario. The president of a mid-sized company was asked by the firm's biggest U.S. customer to provide products to its subsidiary in Thailand. For fear of losing the business, the president's initial reaction would likely be, "Sure, we can do that." Although never having conducted business outside of North America, the team starts learning about ocean shipping, payment terms, and other administrative details they had no idea existed. While they encountered some setbacks, such as when product got stuck in customs because the special import permits were required, the president forged ahead and traveled to Thailand to meet, greet, and train the customer. He was excited about the additional revenue and already was thinking about where else the company might leverage a U.S. customer's foreign locations. However, the success was short-lived. In the following months, customer complaints began to come in, which required the president to send U.S. colleagues to fly to Thailand, adding significant expenses. Even worse, U.S. customers started to inquire about the issues. Management needed to figure out how to actively support local customers, but did not know where to begin. In today's global environment, the opportunities to do international business have never been greater, but few U.S. companies begin with a vision to become an international company. Instead, certain triggers force them to consider going international, such as a customer asking to buy products outside the U.S., a foreign company making inquiries via the web, or a company's need to benefit from global arbitrage to buy the same product or service for a different price abroad. No matter what the reason, a company should consider the following points when contemplating international business. Think strategically and in phases about the opportunity as if it was an investment, because it is. Resources in terms of time and money are required to doing international business, and all too often companies think and plan out steps 1, 2, and 3, but do not have the foresight and experience in knowing that there are 5 other steps that will make or break the investment. Companies often fail to consider the broader context and what it takes to buy or sell abroad. Factor in hidden costs. One of the biggest challenges in doing international business is understanding one's total cost structure. Often different costs apply compared to doing business in the U.S., including special permits, third-party testing, value-added or other taxes, payment mechanism, and true support costs. This is where proper due diligence is required, including local market knowledge. Understanding the true economic feasibility right from the start will help companies avoid making costly mistakes. Leverage external resources to learn what you do not know. As an analogy, if companies face a legal challenge, they undoubtedly seek advice from an attorney who has experience in the matter. The same is true for accounting, human resources, and many other functions. Talk to people who have experience doing international business and tap starter resources such as those provided by the Department of Commerce. It is important to get the right assistance to properly manage your investment right from the start. Going international, no matter how small the endeavor, requires planning, and also will alter some of your existing practices. For example, if a company wants to sell software to resellers in Europe, a myriad of issues have to be considered to meet local expectations, such as different languages for packaging, training manuals, 24/7 local time zone-based technical support, pricing methods to consider, different tax structures. The opportunities for international business will continue to expand in this increasingly flat world. At the same time, however, doing international business is by definition growth outside your core, and thus needs to be viewed and managed as such. And now we're going to read the In the Workplace column written by Edward Marshall, and the headline on the column, A Culture of Truth-Telling in the Workplace. It happens every day. A member of the workforce decides to take a risk to tell his or her truth to senior leadership about a business problem, and there is a reprisal. Not only can you say goodbye to trust, this kind of situation often goes viral, but you can also probably forget having a workplace environment that employees consider safe, i.e. where they can speak their truths to power without retribution. This is not to say that one incident a culture will make, but more often than not, where there is one reprisal, especially without that leader being held accountable, there is a culture of fear, and this one incident merely reflects the mosaic employees know all too well. When employees don't trust their leadership to listen to their truth, there are all kinds of consequences for the business. A culture where fear drives workforce behavior, leadership may not be considered credible, a lack of alignment among the workforce on the overall strategy, a higher level of internal competition, top talent turnover, service quality drops, a loss of change agility. What can be done about this? Here are 7 things senior leadership might consider. Make a commitment to move from fear to trust as their primary cultural driver. Audit the culture, including 360-degree feedback for leadership, document the level of trust and fear across the workplace. Model the way by creating its own internal collaborative governance process, which ensures they are all operating by the same rules of engagement. This will radiate across the organization. Feedback processes are put in place like roundtables to ensure that the truth gets to senior leadership on a regular basis, and they respond in kind by making concrete decisions to address workforce concerns. Hold accountable any leader-manager who fires or threatens an employee because they gave constructive feedback. Retribution is unacceptable. And build an ownership culture that every member of the workforce has a stake in the work processes they implement every day. What's in it for me? Speaking truth to power is not easy for either leadership or the workforce, but global competition requires that we change how we lead, and that means creating more truthful, trust-based, collaborative workplaces. And in doing that, we not only reduce or eliminate fear, but we create workplaces fit for the human spirit that then enable our organizations to soar. The author of this column is Dr. Edward Marshall. He works with senior leadership to build high-trust collaborative leadership cultures and practices. He is author of the bestseller, Building Trust at the Speed of Change. Now in the Triangle Business Journal, we have a short article written by Don Curry. The headline is, The Triangle Headed for a Craft Beer Bubble. If you're making less than good beer, or if you're not totally engaged in managing your business intelligently and actively, you may be at risk for being subsumed in a bubble burst, says Raleigh lawyer John Szymankiewicz, who runs the Beer Law Center. The Washington, D.C.-based Brewers Association's economist, Bart Watson, defines a bubble as a period of overinvestment where asset prices aren't aligned with reality. In other words, people are betting on a future that won't exist. As for the triangle, Watson says there is little to be concerned about because growth of the craft beer industry in the triangle is following the national growth pattern of steady expansion. And with our remaining time with the Triangle Business Journal, we'll turn to the 9-to-5 column. Raleigh-based Maupin Travel has been sold to Trevor and Jordan Smith. Maupin, founded in 1979, has 40 employees who will remain on staff, with Trevor Smith serving as new president of the company. He plans to keep former company president Tony Maupin to serve as director of strategic development. Husband and wife team Don and Kathy Rice of Chapel Hill recently became new owners of Molly Maid of Chapel Hill, a residential cleaning business. The couple purchased the operation from Kathy Rice's father early this year. Southport Marina was recently named the 2013 Large Marina of the Year by Marina Dock Age magazine at the International Marina and Boatyard Conference in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. "We are very proud to be recognized with this significant award," said Thad Moore, who oversees marina operations. Moore is also vice president of finance at Preston Development Company. Southport Marina is located on the Intercoastal Waterway at mile 309, approximately halfway between Wrightsville Beach and Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. And we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. You can contact us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.